evening we are to talk on the subject of the solar symbolism as it relates to the mystery of the Messiah, as this mystery was understood by ancient peoples. In order to get a little background for this theme, we want to go a little further in establishing our great system of astronomical symbolism. About 300 years before the beginning of the Christian era, there lived a man by the name of Eratus. He came from the area of Soli, which is now Cilicia, and it was from this same region that St. Paul came. It may therefore be due to this and to the great esteem in which Eratus was held that he is considered today as the only non-Christian writer, non-Jewish writer, to be quoted in the New Testament. The quotation occurs in the 17th chapter of St. Paul. Paul is speaking in Athens at his famous sermon given by the altar of the unknown God. And he says, in addressing the Athenians, "As your poets have said," referring to God, "we are his offspring." This is from the fifth line of the Phenomena of Eratus of Soli. Eratus was no astronomer, and yet, weirdly or strangely enough, we regard him today as one of the most important figures in the history of astronomical research. He was a physician, a man of letters, an outstanding poet, and spent the second part of his life, second half, in the court of the King of Macedonia. The king was very much interested in the astronomical researches of a previous scholar who had left a number of verses and also considerable prose material under the general title, The Appearances. This title meant to imply the appearances of the heavens at different seasons and times. Eratus took the original notes and composed a magnificent poem of about 800 verses. In this poem, he epitomizes for us the astronomical knowledge of his time, a knowledge which was largely observational. But he gives us a number of things to think about, which have endeared him to the memory of the world. First of all, he indicates through his poem very clearly that at this time, his day, the great system of constellational symbols which we know now was already thoroughly established. He also tells us in the poem that these symbols had descended to his day from a remote and unknown antiquity. There is almost always an association between Eratus and the Greek scholar, statesman, and philosopher Thales. Thales went to Egypt about the 6th century B.C., and perhaps from the Egyptians learned of the mysteries of the heavens. In any event, he is, by legend, accredited with the invention of a heavenly sphere, that is, a kind of globe, like our terrestrial globe. The outer surface of this sphere, studded with stars and connected together to form the outlines of the constellations. So the ancients, by the 6th century B.C., definitely had a spherical concept of the heavens, and they had made a kind of map or chart of all the constellations and the orbits of the planets and most of the other basic astronomical phenomena. The record left by Eratus of Soli, based upon these earlier writings and traditions, has made possible the uranographic charts and the system which we now use in representing the phenomena of the sky. So he was a very important man. And he gave us in his poem a great number of legends showing the close association in the Greek mind, the Near Eastern mind in general, between these star groupings and the great systems of myths, legends, and fables, which have always formed a part of Greek culture. Aratus points out that in all probability, the star groups were named for the exploits and for the various deities and the various symbols with which they were associated. As, for example, the wonderful exploit of the Argonautic expedition was preserved in the heavens in the form of the constellation Argo, the ship. Now, we also realize that in Greek myths, when a human being achieved a very heroic estate and became more than human, he was in the end frequently picked up and carried into the sky to form a star or a constellation. Several mortals were so honored. This probably merely tells us that the physical or human exploits of the person became part of the astronomical lore of the people. Therefore, when we point out certain parallels in symbolism between astronomy and religion, as has been rather clearly set forth by numbers of writers in their astrotheological dissertations, we do not mean to imply that our religion merely began as star worship. Rather, we mean to convey the idea that by degrees we bestowed upon the heavens certain concepts which arose within the human being himself. The heavens were like a vast mirror, sparkling with lights. And man, looking into this magic mirror of the sky, saw rising before his mental eye strange visions, wonderful symbolic patterns. And the more he meditated upon these, the more he filled them in out of his own understanding, until the strange, dark mystery of night became indeed a processional of wonderful figures, symbols, and devices. By degrees, man interpreted the lives of deities and of heroes in terms of the sidereal elements and factors. In his study of the heavens, man was immediately impressed by that powerful star which was for him the giver of life. That star is the sun. Men of old did not worship the sun. They represented it, however, as the most appropriate symbol of the eternal source of life and light. Seeking for words which failed, for various devices which were inadequate, any means they could imagine by which they could honor the great giver of life, ancient man could find no emblem more splendid, no symbol more appropriate, no device more essentially truthful than this blazing orb of day. So throughout the world, in all ages and times, the sun became associated with religion. It was associated because, as the great Theriolachlyton Amenhotep IV pointed out, that the sun is the nourisher, the life giver. It shines upon both the just and the unjust. It recognizes no difference in creed or color or race. It is not denied to one people and given to another. The grain of the believer and the unbeliever planted in the earth will sprout with the light of the sun. The sun, therefore, is a universal concept. It belongs to no time. It bears upon itself no strange limiting symbols belonging to one group of culture or another. It is the ever-splendid orb of day. It is that which lifted man from the terror of night. In ancient times, men were afraid of darkness. They huddled in their caves and huts through the long, dark hours of night, fearful of strange animals and of disasters which came to those who wandered about in darkness. But with the rising of the sun, the world of realities was once more revealed. The ghosts retired. The demons were no longer powerful. The spirits of the dead returned to their graves. And just as the story of the crowing of the cock heralded the end of the danse macabre, the strange dance of death, so the dawn, heralded by the chanticleer, brought with it ever-renewed hope of good times, of happiness, and permitted men to see the faces of each other without doubt or worry. Thus the sun was benevolent. It warmed those that were cold, and while sometimes the tyranny of its rays caused great heat, for the most part in temperate zones where these philosophies were developed, it was a friend the coming of which promised fertility, the time of planting. It was also the friend that brought the ripening of the harvest. It was also the friend whose departure in winter was a cause of the deepest regret. And the rebirth of this friend at the vernal equinox was the subject of continuous universal rejoicing. So the sun in itself was a wonderful and beautiful emblem to ancient man. Now the Egyptians, looking about them by the side of the Nile, where the sandy bank flowed down to the water, and where there was in good season much mud, which was the life of Egypt, observed a very curious thing. There was a little insect, a beetle, called the Scarabasaca. It was very much like our familiar June bug. But this little beetle was a very industrious little creature. It would lay its eggs in a ball of mud, or perhaps of cattle dung. Then it would push this ball with its hind legs backward, usually up some slight incline. And when it had reached the top of the little incline, the beetle let go of the ball, which rolled to the bottom again. It then went down and rolled the ball up again. Now this might seem to be merely a fragment from Dante's Inferno, but actually this little beetle was gradually rounding the shape of the ball. It was taking this rough earth and gradually producing a pellet as perfect as a child's marble. When all was exactly the way the Scarabaeus wanted the ball, it was then able by this same strange backward motion to push it along, rolling it on the ground a considerable distance until it came to the place which the insect had decided was suitable for the incubation of the eggs within the ball. Plutarch says the Egyptians believed that this little beetle actually rolled the ball into the Nile, or, as by symbolism, returned the seeds to the water of life. This beetle, therefore, was a very interesting figure to the Egyptian mind, and they could not divorce the idea that this little ball rolled along the ground was very much like the sun being rolled across the sky, that the sun was a kind of a body which contained the seeds of light, and these seeds were rolled up the hill from dawn till noon and rolled down the hill from noon to night, a great arc of the sky. The Scarabaeus then, for, became known as Khepera. And Khepera is a very interesting word in Egyptian because it has two distinct meanings. It is one of the titles of the sun god, and figures of the deity Ra as Khepera sometimes are shown with the scarab over the head. Sometimes a human figure has the scarab for a head, but it was definitely a solar symbol. But as a solar symbol, Khepera if you analyze the word as the Egyptian used it, means the becoming, or to be, or that which is all marvelous and wonderful. By extension, transformation. For out of this little ball of mud or dung was born the new living thing. It was the old sun god dying each year and being born again in the mystery of the annual resurrection. In their glyphs, the Egyptians sometimes represented the sun with the beetle in the center. And at some seasons, the beetle's wings were spread in beautiful color. And in other seasons, the wings were folded under the stony shell. The British Museum has one of the most magnificent scarabs, I suppose, in the world. It is of green basalt, representing the god Khepra. And you all know these little scarabs that we sometimes see in rings and things of that nature. Well, the great one in the British Museum is 5 feet in length, magnificently carved as the symbol of the deity of the sun. In their practical religion, of course, the Egyptians made use of the scarab for a number of devices. One was to replace the heart in the embalming of the mummy. What is called the heart scarab is usually about 3 inches in length and was placed in the cavature in the body left by the removal and separate embalming of the heart. This scarab was inscribed on the reverse with lines from the Book of the Dead. These lines were in the form of a prayer, asking that the great gods of Amenhotep should hear the prayer of the heart of the deceased and carry him safely through the mystery of death into the beautiful world of everlastingness. The scarabus was therefore the symbol of the resurrection. It was a creature that seemed to belong to the earth, but it could spread its wings and fly off into the sky. It was an ungainly creature, but beautiful in motion, according to the Egyptian concept, forever rolling its little ball back to the sacred Nile. Thus this became a very important solar emblem, and the great ship of the sun is shown supported by the claws of Khepra, the scarab. And the pharaohs wore this device as the symbol of their spiritual and temporal authority. Now we have a sun symbol, the scarab, representing not only the orb in the sky, but everlastingness, the resurrection of the dead, the restoration of the soul, the purification of those who passed into the other life. Therefore, the scarabus was hymned as the symbol of the God who preserves, the God who is ever mindful, the God who lifts all things from darkness into light. By this same type of parallel, the sun itself gradually came to be not only an emblem of life in the sense of the great generic quality of existence, it became the symbol of the restoration of life. It became the symbol of hope, of the restoration of all things that were dark and mysterious. As it rose in all its glory, it was the victory of wisdom over ignorance, of soul over body, of good over evil, of truth over error. In fact, it was the symbol of the total resurrection of the perfect world, represented by and personified by the great God of the sun himself. In Egypt also, the sun had many symbols. And in the wonderful hymn to the sovereign sun, the Emperor Julian describes one of the most famous of the figures of the sun in the later religion of Egypt. This was Aserapi, whom we know as Serapis, the great divinity, the guardian of the Alexandrian libraries. And we have some record from early time as to the nature and appearance of this deity. The Serapeum, which was his house in Alexandria, North Africa, was a splendid building with a high domed center and with extensions like the transepts of a church moving outward. And this place was filled with books, the great records, the recordings and reports of men from the earliest times, books upon stone and clay, books upon papyrus and other strange materials, originally some of wood and metal, and a little later, some upon the skins of animals. Over this great library, which was said to have contained more than 400,000 pieces of recorded material, presided the wonderful symbolic figure of the Alexandrian Serapis. We do not know too much about the origin and meaning of the word. Serapis was not originally an Egyptian deity. It is quite possible that he came from Asia Minor. In any event, some temples and records about him have been discovered in Syria and the Lebanon. In any explanation, however, he came to Egypt and became one of the principal deities of the great Greek dynasty of pharaohs, the Ptolemies. Here in Egypt he found congenial resting place and a beautiful figure of him on a magnificent throned pedestal stood in the center of the library. The head of Serapis was a strange and noble one. Long hair hung upon his shoulders and a forked beard. Most remarkable were his eyes, which the ancients describe in detail. With all the majesty of this person, the eyes were those of a man of unutterable sadness, a strange brooding face, and as one old writer said, that as you stood and looked at it, you could almost see tears springing up in its eyes. It was called the Weeping God. And yet it stood in all this learning with this strange and incredible sadness. The sadness as though it looked out with infinite solicitude upon a world of suffering. The robed figure of the deity was mysterious also, for some believe that it was an androgynous being. Certainly it was not intended to represent the muscular or heroic type, but the strange, sad, slender scholarship that went with the sadness of the face. Serapis bore upon his head a basket filled with living grain and all the symbols of growth. In one hand he held an instrument resembling a ruler or measuring stick, which was used to estimate the inundation of the Nile, so vital to the survival of the people. Beside him he supported with his other hand a strange staff consisting of the bodies of three serpents twisted together. And these three serpents each had a different head. One of the heads was that of a wolf, another was the head of a lion, and the third, presumably, was the head of a bird. The wolf was called the head of the past, the lion of the present, and the bird of the future. And thus time was twisted together into a strange staff, which was used to support the mysterious figure of the deity. Serapis ruled his world, and the meaning of his name, perhaps from Asur, a form of the word Osiris. Asurapi could be the bull of Osiris, the Hapi or Api being a form of Apis. There is, however, another derivation, namely that it came from a word Seraph, meaning to shine, the glorious. And we find the word in the Old Testament, in the Bible, also in the New Testament, as a symbol of the order or hierarchy of the seraphim, meaning the shiners or the glistening ones. In any event, he was a shiner, because around the head of this sad, mysterious person was a magnificent aureole of sunburst rays. He was a solar deity. He was the sad, dying son of autumn, the sun who descends into the underworld and knows the experience of death. When the time came and the great library was sacked during the period of Theodosius, a mob broke into the Serapeum. For some time the mob remained at a distance, almost unable to approach the figure. They were frightened, they were awed by it. But mobs and panics have no respect for persons or for gods. And finally they attacked the statue, tore it down, demolished it, broke the pedestal upon which it stood, and finally burned the entire library. When the ashes were cold, and men began to search for the remnants and remains of their own vandalism, the church historian Socrates, not the Greek philosopher, the church historian, says that under the pedestal of Serapis, when they excavated after the destruction of the building, was found the monogram of Christ. Well, this is peculiar because that pedestal stood there and was placed there long before the beginning of the Christian era. But in any event, that Serapis was a solar divinity, we know. That this divinity was also regarded with some favor by the early Christians, we also know. For we are told by Clement of Alexandria, the anti-Nicene father, that when the bishops of the church went to Alexandria, they held their services first in the temple of Serapis and afterwards in the church of the Christian sect. This deity, therefore, is another strange and wonderful link with the great mystery of the solar god. We cannot attempt a long and detailed study of all the solar divinities. But in every instance, we find in the faiths of men the emergence of what Carlyle calls the hero myth. Now, the hero myth comes in so many forms, from the most classical and abstract to the most common. Under the veiling of a story like Little Red Riding Hood is the old hero myth. For the wolf in Red Riding Hood is also the same wolf that was on the serpent staff of Serapis, an ancient symbol. A symbol of the devouring by darkness. For the wolf lurked in the night. It lurks in the night of the past. And many a man has been devoured by his own past. It is a ravishing wolf in the conscience and in the souls of men. Just as we are also destroyed and broken by our history in many instances, for we can never escape the limitations imposed by authority and tradition, which are also powers of the wolf. In the same classical grouping, however, we go through Grimm's fairy tales. We go through the legends and stories collected and preserved by Hans Christian Andersen, and we go back to the great classic myths. Here we find the story of St. George of Cappadocia fighting the dragon. This is Apollo slaying Python, another form of the solar myth. For it is always the solar hero who must destroy the dragon of darkness, must save man from the sins and evils of existence. The solar myth also gives us Samson, whose strength was in the locks of his hair, especially in seven locks. And these seven locks, of course, are found in the Gnostic philosophy, where the seven rays of the great leonocephalic lion, the rays of the nimbus, end with the symbols of the vowels and also with the signs of planets. So the seven locks of hair are the seven planets which distribute or are related to the mystery of the strength of the sun god. Samson, of course, is a very thinly veiled reference to the sun. Hercules, likewise, performing his 12 wonders, was a solar hero. And in a little different way, but no less important, we have Achilles and the strange legend of his mysterious death. We also find in the Nordic rites the Sigurd saga, Siegfried or Sigurd becoming the solar hero. For the sun is always the hero of the world, and it is nearly always represented as a radiant, heroic being with long, wavy hair symbolizing its rays, usually blonde or red-headed. Moses is said to have had red hair. This strange reddish golden light, the symbol of the mane of the royal lion of the sun, the lions that decorated the throne of Solomon, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the mysterious royal family of the lion of the Shakai family in India, which gave rise in due course to the birth of Buddha. The lion is another great sun symbol. The exaltation of the lion represents the sun entering the sign of Leo, at which time it tames, captures, or slays the celestial lion, dressing itself in the skin of the lion, and then presents itself as the hero to mankind. The skin of the lion being, of course, the 30 degrees of the constellation of Leo, where the sun is enthroned. Thus these symbols go on and on. But during the course of time, the symbolism changed to a measure because of the shifting pattern of human belief. In China, the Yellow Emperor walks the golden road of the zodiacal band. He is the same hero. And practically every dynasty of the world traces itself back to a sun god, like the Rajputs of India, who regard themselves as descendants of Surya, the god of the sun, in his wonderful chariot drawn by the four-headed horse. These four heads, again, of the horse are interesting because they represent the four yugas, or divisions of time, which are measured by the march of the sun. Chrysostom, the great saint of the Eastern Church, declares that the motions of time are represented by the horses drawing the chariot of the sun god. Always these emblems return, but you have to realize that in ancient times, man did not know of sin as we think of it today. Man did not live in a world in which there was the concept of personal responsibility for evil. In the first place, man knew very little about good and evil. He found only comfort and discomfort, life and death. Gradually, he evolved to a point in which he began to worship gods and godlings and to populate the firmament with mysterious spiritual beings. When he did this, he still did not have any concept of personal evil. He did not believe that the gods were punishing him directly for the things that he did, not in the early time. He believed that the gods ruled their world in their own way. Men were not too important in the life of gods. The gods created a beautiful world. Man could do with it as he willed. And if he willed to do badly, that was his own fault. The gods upon their Olympian heights gazed down untouched and unmoved by the acts of men. Then one of the earliest of the solar heroes, Prometheus, was introduced. And Prometheus stole a spark of the celestial light of the sun and, hiding it in a hollow reed, brought it down to mankind. And the gods, because he had broken their covenant and their will, punished Prometheus and bound him and chained him to a rocky crag of Mount Caucasus and placed a vulture to gnaw upon his liver. And Prometheus, the friend of man who brought the sun into the life of man, was one of the earliest of the sun soul figures. For after his strange and wonderful sacrifice, the gods could no longer destroy men at their pleasure, because the spark of the divine fire which he had brought now blazed within each human soul. and man had achieved immortality by disobedience. It's a very interesting legend and a very powerful psychological theme. Prometheus, therefore, is one of the soul men who sacrifices himself for the good of the world. The story of the sun, as we said, can be traced in your Nordic rites in the Kalevala of Finland and in the wonderful massive stone carvings of Central America, Yucatan, and also in the paintings and glyphs of the North American Indians. Always this wonderful theme has to do with the light giver, the life bestower. Osiris in the Egyptian ritual was sometimes represented as a mummified body lying upon the lion-like couch of death, and all over his body grain was sprouting. He was therefore a symbol of life coming forth from death. The mummification of the Egyptian dead was a comparatively late introduction. That is, it came only after the great cultural system of Egypt had reached considerable height. The very earliest remains of the Egyptians were not mummified, but were buried in the earth in the neat chest or embryo posture in a circular hole or grave. This was to symbolize the fact that death was another birth. To live is to die is to be born. The Egyptians therefore represented death as a kind of birth into another world, and they represented this also in their solar mystery. They realized that the sun sank at night, but the sun did not die, although the earth became dark. They began to learn of how the tree in the wintertime loses its leaves but does not die, and the cultus arborum, or the worship of trees, developed around the fact that the tree, though seemingly dead, will live again. And one of the best known examples of that, of course, today is the symbol of the fir tree, which we use at Christmas to recognize the fact that this little tree survives the winter, remains green, and is the promise of the return of the sun power. So the sun, in its departing and in its returning, became of the most profound importance, because man recognized his total and entire dependence upon it. Now, man also had certain moral qualms in his own heart and mind, and he began to realize that the sun deity, or the sun principle, the life principle, was in a strange way an unselfish benefactor of all things. Akhenaten and other great Egyptians, including Imhotep, realized that in a strange way man needed the sun, but that the sun did not need man. Some way the coming of this great orb of light was for the good of man, or for the good of nature, not really for the aggrandizement of itself. It was therefore a sort of unselfish benefactor. It, needing nothing of itself, gave all of itself. Having nothing that man could do to make the sun better, the sun still did everything for man. Man could never repay. He could never do anything except perhaps offer his prayer and offer his consecration to the works of the sun. The sun did not need him. And this brings us to a problem that is of some interest perhaps in modern thinking, because today we are very much concerned over the effort to find adequate definitions for deity or for the nature of first cause, and we argue back and forth as to whether or not God is a person, a principle, a being, an essence, a substance, or merely a continuance of eternal mechanistic principles in the universe. And nearly every title that men have given to the sun, other men have questioned and doubted. And wherever the solar deity has been venerated under one name, this name has come to be hated or loathed by persons of other beliefs. It's a very strange thing, but let us realize one point here that may be helpful. That in antiquity, in the days when the great appellations were given to the sun, Nobody thought of them as definitions. No one was really trying to tell what the sun was, nor what the power was that was behind the sun. No one was standing in audacity to define deity. All of these terms, if you go back to their roots and meanings, are simply statements of praise. They are individuals bestowing upon the mystery the most wonderful words of honor and of veneration that they could conceive. It was no effort to define, it was simply that man bestowed every title that was good or beautiful or noble upon this supreme symbol of his own existence. Also, man, early in his experimenting in thought and philosophy, sensed that there was within his own nature a kind of life that was derived in some way from the life of the total universe. So he, as the Egyptian did, used the scarab, or the symbol of Kepra, the sun, as an emblem for his heart. If the sun had a place in the life of man, that place was in the heart, which was the source of man's life, and strangely more than his mind, the source of his light. For man's great light comes not from his thought, but from his love. And in realizing this, the individual who had experienced the mystery of the love of God was a light within himself, a strangely illumined being. And in his life, this great symbol of radiance flowed from him. And so the heart became the sun emblem. And the heart has long been represented as the source of man's spiritual continuance. When the deceased priestess, princess Hanufa, entered into the presence of the great gods of Amentet in the Egyptian ritual of the dead, she came forth into the great court, forming with her upraised arms the symbol of the Ka, by means of which she said, "I am a soul. I am a being unembodied," entering into the state of unembodiment. And the symbol of her nature, her conscience, and her being was a small urn-like vessel with an ear on the side. And this vessel was the heart. And it was from the heart that the Lady Hanufa spoke when she answered the questions of the great God and the jurors. And it was her heart that was weighed on the scale of the balance against the symbol of eternal truth. The Egyptians had already decided, beyond any question, that if the glorious light of space existed in man, or had a home or abode in man, it was in the aditum of his temple, in the inner part, which was his own heart. And Hermes, in his essay or discourse to his son Tatian, says that the divine power placed the heart in man like the pyramid in Egypt. And the pyramid also, a fire-like symbol, was a representation of the heart as the symbol of the solar mystery. Now, way back through all these centuries of descent, this overtone, this concept lingered. But as we say, men changed their thinking. And in the course of time, there arose a doctrine of sin. And sin in this case was separation. Sin created only one situation, namely that creatures who sinned were regarded as separating themselves from the good God. Thus, by fall or relapse or by departure, spiritually, morally, or physically, from the code, man created an interval between himself and the good. He was no longer able to see the God that walked with him in the garden in the cool of the evening. He lived in another kind of world, a world surrounded by his own kind of creature, But the mysterious upper world, the world of light, was closed to his eyes. He felt himself an exile, a strange kind of orphaned creature, wandering the earth in darkness. And to meet this mystery and to solve the secret of it, the ancients devised their tremendous culture of mystery rituals. These were the sacred dramas and sacred ceremonies which were undertaken by those who desired to journey back into the light of the God. Always, therefore, in the Holy of Holies, or the Sanctum Sanctorum of the house, in the deepest part of the temple, was a sun symbol of some kind, a symbol of life, a symbol of power. One of the earliest of these sun symbols was the cross, because, as Plato points out, the logos, or the creating power, impressed itself in the form of a cross at the time when it first began the building of worlds. It impressed itself upon creation in the great signature or seal of the cross. Thus in the temples we find these symbols, symbols of the attainment of man who must journey home. This journey home was through the darkness of ignorance, through testing and trial, and finally the ascent into the lighted sanctuary where, surrounded by the priests and those who had already attained, the candidate was invested with the great solar emblems, the emblems of his own regeneration and restoration. It was then also that he was given the little white stone, upon the inner surface of which was inscribed his mystery name, for he was born again. He had come into the light of truth. The old systems of the mysteries extended probably from 2500 to 3000 BC, down almost to the beginning of the Christian era. And then we have what Voltaire refers to in his description of the Samothracian rites, the mystery of a brother who was slain by his brethren. And we find in the old mystery rituals the solar emblem, the candidate representing the sun god, passing through a terrible tragedy, a tragedy of betrayal, of assault, of murder, of martyrdom. We find this solar emblem brought forth as a lamb to the slaughter. We find it betrayed. And we look back over the history of the world and we begin to understand something of this betrayal. In many of these systems or symbolisms, the betrayal was the result of the action of three persons who were determined to destroy the solar emblem, or to usurp the power of heaven. Consider, therefore, now that the sun god, Kepra or Serapis, ruled over the great sanctuary of wisdom. For in the great library of the Serapeum were the talking stones that told the history of the world. Here were the records of ancient times and of the achievements of men, the dreams and hopes that were old even 2,500 years ago. Therefore, Serapis was the symbol, in a sense, of the records of man's progress, passed on as a priceless heritage from one generation to another. The record of man's struggle, his uprising out of darkness, and his coming forth by day out of the night of ignorance. And in this sense, the sun deity finally becomes the actual symbol of truth, becomes the figure of a reality which is the total of essential knowledge. It is therefore quite understandable how the decline and corruption of the mysteries could be considered as an assault upon the body of a god. Just as Serapis was broken from his wonderful pedestal and smashed to 1,000 bits, so the ancient system of learning, which was the essential principle of united knowledge, was torn from its ancient sacred footing, cast down, destroyed, broken, scattered by the embodiment of three powers of darkness, powers that we call ignorance, superstition, and fear. It is the ignorance of the mass, the superstitions of false faith, and the fear of temporal power. These are the things that gradually corrupted and destroyed the great institutions of learning, martyred the teachers, crucified, poisoned, murdered, until the wonderful system of mystery initiation was no more, destroyed and corrupted, so that the temple was brought down like the house of the Philistines, and Samson, the sun god, died in the destruction of the house which he pulled down with his own hands. So the house of wisdom, when it fell, carried the symbol to darkness with it, but also resulted in the fall of the house of the Philistines. And the world that has mutilated, defamed the mysteries is now itself weakened, darkened, living in fear and doubt, living in moral and ethical uncertainty, wandering in a darkness, knowing not what direction to turn, still proud of its worldly wisdom, but afraid of darkness and afraid of its own sleep. These things then can have and do have a variety of interpretations. And in these interpretations we discover many of the ancient beliefs and doctrines. Now, if you will study, as we attempted to show you in the first lecture of this series, the ancient relation of the zodiac, the solar system, and the sublunary elemental spheres of the earth, you will see that in the ancient concept of things, the sun occupies the middle distance between heaven and earth. Robert Flood, the great Rosicrucian mystic, whose designs and figures so influenced Kepler, was of the opinion, therefore, that in the great monochord of the world, the single-stringed musical instrument binding heaven to earth, the sun was the central fret, or divided the string into two equal halves. This also was found in the Gnostic and Greek mysteries, and in the mysterious lute of Orpheus. If the sun, therefore, be suspended in the very center of the great system of intervals, known in Pythagorean astronomical music, it would be like man, as described in Goethe's Faust, as standing twixt heaven and earth, dominion wielding. Above the orbit of the sun, to the ancients, was the superior world. Below the orbit of the sun was the inferior world. The sun was not only the symbol of the deity, particularly of the only begotten, for the sun, S-U-N, and the S-O-N form were almost interchangeable from the beginning. The sun was not only, therefore, in this middle distance, representing God, but also, strangely, represented man. Man, some way, belonged to the order of the sun, because he himself stood like Serapis, with his feet upon the earth and his head in heaven. Man possessed the power to turn his outward senses downward into the confusion of the material sphere. But he also had the power to lift his inner sensory perceptions and apperceptive powers upward and inward to behold the mystery of his own creator. Man is the only animal that we know that seeks to understand God. Perhaps others do not have to seek. Perhaps in their souls they know. But man has created an entire part of his life built upon the profound aspiration after truth, and even the corruptions of ages cannot prevent the gradual motion of man towards the emancipation of his life from ignorance. Thus man has the power to understand mysteries of the spirit, even as he has power to understand the wonders of the body. Thus between the two extremes, suspended in a world of rarefied internal atmosphere, man has something that psychology and the Greeks both call the ego, the focal point of selfness. And this ego is like a sun in the center of man. And it is this sun which is in some way stationed halfway between illusion and reality. This symbolism should be of considerable interest to psychologists, because they have taken in many instances the attitude that the ego, or the center of self-awareness, is the ultimate, that it is the highest part of man. The ancients said no. It is one bearing witness. It is one who stands in the midst, a psychopompus, an hierophant of mysteries, not a god, but a servant of the gods, not the master of destiny, but the attendant upon destiny. For above and beyond the ego, as Plato tells us, the world turns upon the great spindle of the law. If then man has a spiritual core within himself, recognizes his kinship with the solar mystery, he then realizes that the light that comes from within himself lights the lower world, and that man's mind